Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We're joined by Ridgely Fuller, a social worker and peace activist with Code Pink. She's been to Israel and Palestine during trips in 2002, 2003, and 2009, and she most recently visited Gaza. Ridgely Fuller is touring the East Coast with a slideshow on Palestine. She will visit Connecticut September 14th to speak at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield. It's at 7 p.m. at 549 Storrs Road. Ridgely Fuller, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you start by talking about your reasons for doing this kind of educational project?
Most of the talks I've done has either been in Maine or small groups in Massachusetts. And I think part of what people are really hungry for is for real information. You know, Israel doesn't allow a lot of media in, and because our mainstream media doesn't report on what's really going on in Palestine, both the West Bank and Gaza. So I think people who are peace activists are really hungry for information. For that kind of population, I really hope to encourage the kind of activism that's so important.
Now, like many other members of Code Pink, you also visit Congress, right?
Right. What I'm most interested in is in talking to groups of people who are not necessarily already totally committed to the Palestinian issue. I feel like, you know, I've just been reading John Lewis's autobiography, The Civil Rights Leader, who talked about the importance of broadening people's mind, not necessarily being able to change them, but at least broaden them. And I think that's what I really try and do. And with that in mind, I have been within the last month, I've been to Susan Collins' office up in Maine, and I don't know if you're aware, but she is a very strong supporter of the current Israel policy. So going into her office was very interesting, talking to one of their aides. I've been to Senator Kerry's office and talked with the aides there. I'm actually going to Congressman Delahunt's office on Thursday.
Bill Delahunt, the 10th District of Massachusetts.
We've been trying to get an appointment with my Congressman, Ed Markey, since January, and this has been a consistent effort on our part where we've been making daily phone calls, we've had vigils, we've had small and large groups going in requests, we've had petitions throughout his district, just to ask to have a meeting with him. First, it was to talk about Gaza and the war and the siege on Gaza. And those phone calls, none of them have been even answered. It's just an absolute amazing situation. 2 weeks ago, I went to an event where he spoke at a temple in Lexington, and I actually approached him, and I told him that there was a group of us who had been trying to meet with him since January, and he said he would be very willing to meet with us. I talked to his aide and said, "You've heard this on the record," and the aide said, "Yes." I've been to his office, I made phone calls, and still they don't respond. So this is like an exercise in democracy at this point, you know. But I think there are a lot of congressmen that just don't get a lot of information. 5 years ago, when I came back from the West Bank, Barney Frank was my congressman, and he met with me alone. He gave me probably 40 minutes of his time to look at the slides I had of the West Bank, and the wall was just being built at that point. And I asked him where he got his information from about Israel and the Palestinian issue, and he talked about it was really mainstream media, and we know that mainstream media is not covering this issue at all. So, again, whether it's congressional offices or audiences that don't maybe have a lot of information, part of what I really try to do is broaden their kind of experience. And I think about the apartheid movement in South Africa, and I think that boycott, divestment, and sanctions is so important. But as far as my knowledge is that once Congress ended up voting to support the sanctions, that's when the president of South Africa at that point started meeting with Mandela. So even though a lot of people think that I'm batting my head against the wall, in fact, I rename myself as Patsy Fuller because I'm the Patsy for thinking that Ed Markey's office is going to respond to me in as a respectful way as that I have maintained in his office. I feel like that's a really important thing to do. So one of the things I'm hoping to do in the fall is to get a lot of information about the effect of U.S. weapons in Gaza and to make a 10-minute presentation out of that and go to the congressional offices in Washington.
The Bush administration, of course, negotiated a 10-year agreement to provide $30 billion in military aid to Israel, and that aid rained down as of February 2009 in the form of 500-pound bombs and Hellfire missiles and white phosphorus artillery shells. Why don't you talk about the significance of the impact of U.S. weapons on the people of Palestine?
In Gaza, one of the things that I learned about was this new piece of military equipment called DIME, and it's an explosive rocket that releases tiny, tiny little pellets, and it's radioactive. The Norwegian doctors there had never seen anything like it. This is such a new weapon that the world community has not been able to outlaw it yet, like white phosphorus. This new DIME rocket, which they say is going to become so popular because it's only 6 feet long, it doesn't weigh a whole lot, but it causes incredible organ damage. It also does a lot of huge, serious amputations. And it also, for people who are able to survive it, and this is according to U.S. military information, the rate of cancer is 99% in the testing they did on rats. There's titanium in it. And we, the U.S. government sold Israel 1,000 of these weapons in September. Many of them were used. I really believe that the Palestinians, and I'm not the only person who believes this, are used as experimental kind of laboratories for weapons. And I actually believe that the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition is going to be writing a book about this fall. And it has to do with heavily, densely populated areas. Armies are trying to learn how to control these areas. And in some ways, Gaza, I think, is used as a laboratory. So you have the DIME stuff, you have white phosphorus, you have F-16s that are so prevalent, being used all the time, Apache helicopters shooting rockets. I have pictures of, there's a Samuni family that was even featured in Newsweek, that mainstream media, when they start talking about these things, you know that it's a big deal. And they lost 26 members of their own family. The Israelis came in, put 100, I think, of the Samuni families in one home, and then that was shelled by Apache rockets. So it was flattened on top of them, and 26 people were killed. I went and spent a day visiting that family, and they have, you know, I have pictures of them with the rocket shells that are clearly U.S. made. Now, it's against U.S. law for weapons that we export to be used in an aggressive way. They're only supposed to be able to be used for defensive purposes. So it's clearly illegal. Amnesty International, I believe, is talking about, you know, we should stop military aid. We should certainly stop it until Israel and the international community has been willing to make a really impartial assessment of how these weapons have been used.
Just give us a sense now of both the damage from Israeli bombing this past winter and also the increase in military pressure still coming from Israel.
One of the doctors that I met talked about how the people in Gaza are in a prison. You know, nobody's really allowed in, no one's allowed out. But despite being in a prison, now they're not even allowed to live in peace within that prison. The coast is constantly being shelled by the Israeli Navy. International law and the Oslo Agreement said that the Palestinians would have 20 miles of fishing rights. Well, that's been reduced to 3 miles, and that's a unilateral decision by Israel, who shell any boat that approaches the 3 mile limit. And even within that limit, boats are being harassed a lot, and fishermen are being abducted and kidnapped. And this is even documented by the Israeli press, so this is nothing new. And then if you go on the east side, where is the big agricultural zone, which is actually probably, I think they said 60% of the best land, of agricultural land for farmland, is that Israel has unilaterally prevented farmers from using that land. Initially, there was this buffer zone that was maybe 200 meters, and now since, actually during the ceasefire, Israel increased that to 350 meters, and I've just read reports now that farmers are being shot within 500 meters of the border. So the land that they're able to use is really being squished. And you talk about 1.5 million people in a very, very small area. You know, and similarly, the whole northern area, and they talk about 1.5 kilometers, was totally destroyed. Everything there, the houses, that's where a lot of the industrial sector was, that's all been flattened. And I think Senator Kerry was there in the spring. Other congresspeople have been there to visit and have really been, according to my, when I've talked to the UN there, they have been appalled by the amount of destruction there. So I think it's important for people to be able to see the conditions under which the Palestinians in Gaza are now being forced to live. And I think in terms of the density, it's 2/3 of the people who live in Gaza are actually refugees from Palestine of 1948, when Israel was made a state, and there were so many refugees, there were people who were forced to flee. So they're still living in refugee camps in Gaza, and Jabalia up in the north, the density there is 75,000 per square kilometer. New York City, it's 25,000 per square kilometer, and the settlements in the Western Bank, which Netanyahu, they want to keep expanding, is only 625 people per square kilometer. So I think it gives you a sense of the relativity of the way people are living.
Just say more about the still relatively new but right-wing government of Benjamin Netanyahu. Were you surprised to see someone like him come to power in Israel again with his even more extreme foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman?
I think there are many of us in our trips to Palestine, our meeting with lots of Palestinians, are very concerned that Israel wants the resources and the land of the Palestinians, but is not particularly interested in making peace. I think there's a lot of evidence for that concern. So in some ways, the government in Israel doesn't surprise me. I think I felt like what was very disappointing was that 80% apparently of the Israelis felt that the war on Gaza should be continued, and they were supportive of it, despite the fact that the Israeli Defense Department on their website was showing that during the ceasefire, rockets were not being flown into Israel from Gaza. There was a statement showing a graph showing the decrease in rockets that were being sent over into Israel, and there was an acknowledgement that some of those rockets that did make it over there during the ceasefire were by other groups in Gaza who were determined to make Hamas look bad. So this was all part of the Israeli, you know, military stand. So there was no justification, no self-defense justification for what Israel did in terms of unleashing the invasion on Gaza. It was an aggressive act. There was nothing defensive about it. If they had wanted to continue the ceasefire, that's what they needed to do, was continue the ceasefire. The Hamas government offered twice to continue it. The Egyptian government and the Israeli government both agree with that. Hamas offered to extend the ceasefire despite Israel having broken it on November 4th when they did an incursion into Gaza and killed six Palestinians that they said were building a tunnel into Israel. And if, in fact, that was true, then why didn't they just wait in the Israeli side of the tunnel for them to come out? But they did an incursion, and the ceasefire was broken. So Israel's totally responsible for that. The New York Times and The Guardian and Reuters have all commented that Israel is the one that broke the ceasefire. So I think there are a lot of misconceptions that are flying around.
Now, you've mentioned that it would be possible for Palestinians to get much better health care quickly. There are people trying to bring it in there, but unfortunately, even with some new equipment, the Israelis are not allowing some parts to get in. As I understand it, there's a part missing, for example, from a device used for cancer patients.
So it's a center in the main hospital that was given by an Arab country, and it's this whole new center, and the doctors who work there describe it as a place, it's a body with no soul, because you go in there and everything is new and it's never been used because the MRI equipment lacks a certain kind of isotope that Israel won't allow in, and that's certainly for the cancer center. So that's part of my presentation of these slides of this new equipment that is just sitting there really waiting to be used, and it's all set up, and there's probably about 5,000 people who were wounded during the invasion, and they're talking about 1,700 who are permanently handicapped. So they're either amputees or they have spinal cord or some kind of neurological damage that is really going to totally not just impact their life, but also impact the lives of their families, who will end up spending so much time and resources taking care of these people. As I said, the 1,700 of those, of the wounded, are in this very severe category. And if the hospital that does the rehabilitation was heavily hit, so that many, many rooms they're not able to use. And when we were there in June, it still was in the same condition. As you probably know, people who are needing this kind of rehabilitation and even really good prosthetics are not allowed out of the country. So they have a very hard time getting through Egypt, and if they go through Israel, if they're allowed out, and even the Israeli physicians for human rights have documented that any patients who are coming to Israel at the border, they're required to agree to become collaborators once they go back to Palestine. So there are a number of people who have refused any kind of a medical treatment in Israel. We met several amputees and also a boy who had burns from white phosphorus. Males who are 15 and over are not allowed out of Gaza at all. Women who, I think you can be, as I remember, up to 16 or 17, you can get out for medical treatment. So this is clearly, they're very concerned about having young men being rehabilitated or leaving on the outside. I did run into a 14-year-old who was going to end up going to Seattle to have her prosthesis made, and I was actually trying to help kind of develop some arrangement to help with some support system once he got into the Seattle hospital, but I haven't been able to make contact with the people in Gaza again to make sure that's arranged.
But it sounds like some of what you experienced when you were in Gaza also holds promise as an opportunity for Americans to link up in some way with Palestinians and maybe get something done in spite of some of the blockades to that.
Code Pink was invited by the United Nations, and John Ging is head of UNRWA, which is the United Nations, the organization that worked with refugees, and he talked about the importance of citizen diplomacy when he met us, and he was feeling like that's what we were doing is citizen diplomacy, and Viva Palestina and the Gaza boats, it's all citizen diplomacy, kind of trying to do what governments have not been able to or not been willing to do. I mean, I always felt like when I was there, especially I met with some professors, and that they were very hungry for international access because it's so denied. But most of it's symbolic, and part of what we do is we help humanize what is often considered the enemy by our mainstream media or whoever is defining the world framework at the time. And I think our efforts really are humanizing. I mean, when I went to meet with these professors, and it was kind of accidental, and it was a very interesting meeting. It was a gathering kind of in their association house where they'd go and chat with each other, kind of get support, and they'd meet once a week. And so I was going to take their picture, and they said, no, 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 we want you to take it in the next room. So I went to the next room, and they were all laughing because there was a huge hole in the ceiling where a rocket had come through. So it shows, I think, their sense of humor, their resiliency, and those are human qualities that hopefully we all have, and that we're able to then connect with each other because we realize how much more we have in common. In northern Gaza, on the seacoast, they were trying to build a resort on the Mediterranean. And again, that was another structure that the Israelis closed down. So you have this very bizarre sense of time stopping in a lot of different areas. But you had a lot of internal joy because the Israelis and the settlers were no longer there. Emotionally, I think people felt freer. There wasn't this incredible fear, even though the war had been, or it wasn't even a war because the Palestinians were in no position to defend themselves, but the invasion had happened. But there wasn't that incredible fear, so there was a lot of a freer sense emotionally among the Palestinians.
When you were there, were people more hopeful, you know, having just learned that the White House would now be occupied by a new person, Barack Obama, who has spoken about peace?
Barack Obama actually ended up in Cairo while we were still in Gaza, and I think there was a lot of hope, and that's really true. But I think there's this pervasive sense that the foreign policy of the United States government has not changed, and it's still so supportive of Israel, so that policies like the invasion and the siege and our providing enormous amount of military weapons, all of that is still in place. I didn't really have a sense that they were more hopeful about the American government particularly. I think there was a wait-and-see attitude.
You've had a unique experience in meeting women in particular, but, you know, people from both Israel and Palestine. What has that shown you?
The last time I was in Israel was in 2003 when I was part of this International Women's Human Rights March, and it was a 3-week march. It was organized by Israeli and Palestinian women who had never actually been able to meet face-to-face. So it was fascinating because when we were marching through Israel with the Israeli women, we always had to keep in mind our Palestinian hostesses over across on the other side of the checkpoints. And when we were in Palestine, And we were asked to give speeches and meet in different places. We always had to be aware of our Israeli colleagues. But I think what was really important was that women were doing all this kind of work. And especially in Palestine, where women often are more kind of home-based, our march enabled all the women to come out and march with us. So I feel like there's an enormous amount of strength, and I think nonviolence in women, and I mean, I hate to, is that a terrible stereotypic thing to say, but one of the expressions of Code Pink is, as a mother, I will not raise my child to kill another mother's child. And I think that's something that us as women and many of us as mothers do have in common, so we can kind of think a little bit differently.
I want to play just a little short bit of videotape that I found of you, Ridgely Fuller, leading a large group of Palestinian kids in dancing the Hokey Pokey. Now just tell us what was going on in your mind as you were with all of these kids, because it looked like a really joyful occasion.
I had no language to be able to use with them, so I kind of resort to what's most familiar with me. So I've had training in working with children who've had trauma and working with groups of children. It's actually so interesting because the trainers said, you know, you'll do fine, but something will come up. And so doing the Hokey Pokey, that's what came up. What you didn't see, because it was hard to take pictures, was a lot of yoga. And so I was doing yoga with circles of kids, and it was really interesting being able to kind of model stretches for them. So certainly the laughter was everywhere, you know, and that's certainly something all over the world. And laughter gives you immediate feedback that you know that whatever work you're doing on trauma is being successful because you have people laughing, so that's really good. I felt like the kids, they were incredibly starved for affection and attention, and I think part of that comes from the trauma that a lot of the adults as well as the kids have had, and the families, as I mentioned early on, are taking care of a lot of very injured and traumatized other adults and kids as well. So you have lots of kids who are looking for attention and for nurturing and for positive stuff from adults. So certainly that was an incredible thing. And then the other thing that I was really struck by is that the boys were very dominant, and I guess this is certainly true. I've worked in inner city schools in the United States too, and so that's also been true. But I didn't have language to be able to try and get them to listen to me. So one of the games that I did, I taught these kids how to do Duck, Duck, Goose. I don't know if you remember Duck, Duck, Goose.
Oh, I remember Duck, Duck, Goose.
Well, that was awesome, because the only way to really play Duck, Duck, Goose is to sit in a circle and wait your turn. And you'd have boys who couldn't do that, and they'd be jumping in and out of the circle and running around. When the boys realized that in order to get our kind of attention, they needed to sit in the circle and participate, they really did. And meanwhile, we were modeling for them. So there'd be a lot of times where I would motion to the girls just to say, come on, girls, let's go. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And we're just not going to be able to let the boys come and play until they learn how to do this with us. So it was pretty funny. But I never thought that I'd be doing Duck, Duck, Goose in Gaza. And the kids would end up talking Duck, Duck, Goose. It was funny. It really was.
You remind me of Jo Wilding. She was in, you know, Iraq and touring Iraq with a circus during these very, very dangerous times there, I might add.
Yeah.
And she would kind of arrive with a big movable feast of a circus, and boom shaka, she would shout, and all the kids would come flocking because they had gotten to know what she was doing there.
Yeah.
Kids are kids.
Yeah.
In war or not.
Uh-huh. Right.
So talk about your work as a social worker and what it means to you, Ridgely Fuller, that you're able to have these opportunities to meet with these kids whose lives are so damaged.
It's certainly fun for me. I mean, I laugh as much as they do, and so there's an enormous amount of fun and affection, and that's always positive for everybody, whether it's somebody who's had trauma or somebody who hasn't. There's a lot of personal fulfillment in that, too. I mean, clearly, as I was leaving Gaza, there was only one piece of equipment that I brought with me, and I brought four of them. There were these big parachutes. And I had a lot of activities that I would have wanted to do with kids. and to train other adults in how to do those kind of activities with kids. There just was not the time or the opportunity to be able to do that. And I knew that the adults really need to be well trained in how to do that, because sometimes it is bouncing kids up, and so you don't want it to be dangerous. So by the time when I was leaving, I felt one of my hosts was saying he wanted me to stay for a month because he was running a program this summer for children who've been displaced by war. And I gave him some of the parachutes. I showed him and his family how to use them, and so hopefully they'll would have been able to train a lot of the counselors in their use. And I also ended up meeting some of the UNRWA people at the end who I wish that I'd had contact with in the beginning, and so being able to kind of work with them. So as a social worker, it's hard just to go in and do something for an hour or two that you know is not going to have any kind of impact at all. I mean, it's much more satisfying to be able to go in and train people to be able to make it an everyday kind of occurrence for the children. So I felt very frustrated as well, you know, in leaving so quickly and not having the chance to do what I would have made much more of an impact.
You can always return, we hope.
Well, we hope, but you never know about the borders. You just don't. It's sheer chance if you can get in. You know, and once, actually, I think a lot of the people on the Gaza boats who went in, some of them stayed, and then the Egyptian government said they weren't going to let them out. It's very much like being in prison. If you're lucky enough to be able to get in, then, you know, we as Americans or as Code Pinkers, we have the luxury of leaving with Code Pink. But you can easily be kept in Gaza and have no control over when you're going to be able to get out. And that's really a sacrifice. People who are willing to do that and give up that kind of control over their life, I think they're just, I mean, those are the true heroes. And there have been a lot of those people who have just not been able to get out when they thought they'd be able to.
And Richley Fuller, how is it that you came to be interested in the group Code Pink?
And I was pretty actively opposed to our invasion of Iraq. And Code Pink had a march on Washington, and I went and joined in that march, and it was a wonderfully joyous march. We surrounded the White House in pink, and I think that's a part of Code Pink's philosophy, is that they're against war, whether it's they want to end wars and prevent new ones from beginning, they want to redirect resources to education and green jobs and health care. But they want this to be done in a spirit of joy and humor, and that really attracts me. I feel like, you know, it's so easy to get so disheartened and bogged down because of the real serious work that we're all doing. So that joyfulness, I really think is important. And actually, after that, I came back to Boston. We organized the Code Pink kind of event at Park Street Station here. One, it was April Fool's morning, where we were all dressed, all these women in pink bathrobes with their hair in rollers. Bush was president then, and we had pink towels, and we were all singing, "We're going to wash that man right out of our hair." And people would laugh, and it was a nice way to start the day, you know. So I think there are a lot of ways you can deliver a message for peace and justice, and to be able to deliver that message with some humor, I feel like it's really important. It's real hard, but it's important to do that.
And I guess you haven't put your rollers away during the time Michelle Obama and Barack Obama are in the White House.
No, but I haven't been. Hopefully I'll go down and be more with Code Pink. But I'm extremely concerned about, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan. And, you know, of course, many of us disheartened about the whole issue of our health care and the policies that hopefully will certainly have a public option. I believe the Progressive Caucus and the House, they're the ones I'm pinning my hopes on. I think it's important to keep trying to be joyful and positive. It's really important, yeah.
Ridgely Fuller, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, and I look forward to being in Connecticut.
And we'll link to the video on YouTube of Ridgely Fuller leading Palestinian kids in dancing the hokey pokey. Ridgely Fuller will be speaking in Connecticut September 14th at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield. It's at 7 p.m. at 549 Storrs Road. It's the intersection of Routes 195 and 89. The public is invited. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. One more announcement as to upcoming events. Dar Jamail is coming this September, too. On September 20th at 7 p.m., in fact, he will visit the University of Connecticut in Storrs in an event sponsored by WHUS Radio, the campus station at FM 91.7. For a full listing of events, go to willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. I'm Dori Smith. Our website, talknationradio.org. You'll find a list of other stations airing this show, syndicated with Pacifica Network. Our music is by Fritz Heed. FritzHeed.com. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.